For at least 2 years now, top intelligence officials have insisted that al-Qaeda's strength has been severely degraded. And yet an internet posting earlier this week may suggest the group is trying to taunt those very same officials. A few pages of a flashy new English-language magazine appeared online. It's called Inspire, and it claims to be the product of al-Qaeda, with such headlines as, "Make a bomb in the kitchen of your mom." And it features the work of contributing writers like Anwar al-Awlaki and Osama bin Laden. If it's authentic, it would be the most sophisticated attempt by al-Qaeda to reach English-speaking audiences. Juan Zarate has seen it. He served as Deputy National Security Advisor under President George W. Bush, and he's now with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Juan Zarate, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
A few pages of this magazine were posted on the internet. Firstly, do you think that it's authentic? I mean, do you think this is an al-Qaeda product?
I think it actually is, and I think it demonstrates al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the al-Qaeda brand in Yemen, their attempt to actually consolidate their presence online with the Western publication. Whether or not it ultimately proves to be dangerous is an altogether different question, but I think people think it is coming from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and likely Anwar al-Awlaki, the American Yemeni cleric.
I want to ask you about him in a moment, but first, one of the bylines on the cover, in addition to al-Awlaki, is Osama bin Laden. We don't know if he penned a piece for the magazine. Do you think that bin Laden would even be aware of this publication?
Yeah, the ties between the al-Qaeda branch in Yemen and the al-Qaeda core in the Afghan-Pak border region is actually pretty close. I mean, the people who are running the group in Yemen have long-standing ties to al-Qaeda. I doubt highly that bin Laden sat down to pen something original for this inaugural edition. But, you know, he is certainly aware of what's happening with the movement and certainly aware that he needs to be a voice in it. Interestingly, though, this doesn't come from the al-Qaeda core, the Asahab media arm. This comes from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which I think may be the most significant dimension of this.
Yeah, I want to ask you that because it was printed, allegedly printed by the Yemen branch of al-Qaeda, where, of course, the American-born cleric Anwar al-Awlaki lives. He is believed to be on a U.S. government target list for death. What does it say about his ascendancy in al-Qaeda?
Government officials have clearly now stated, from the CIA director on down, that Anwar al-Awlaki has moved from the mere firebrand to a more of an operational role. Again, one of the interesting things about this publication is it's yet another extension of his attempts to reach Western audiences more broadly.
He's been making online videos for a few years now.
Yeah, no, he's been online. He's been effective in many ways to convert the narrative of radical violent Islamic jihad into, you know, Westernese.
For English speakers.
For English speakers.
Muslim and non-Muslim alike.
Exactly. And in fact, his latest video before this journal has come out was directed to American Muslims, telling American Muslims that they needed to take off the shackles of living here under this government. And so clearly he's trying to foment a sense of division, a sense of this narrative gaining momentum in the West and in particular in the United States. I think what they're hoping with this particular journal is to build on that message, to build on the momentum, and to cast the net very widely to try to attract as many people to take up the violent cause and to commit some act of violence in the U.S. or in the West.
That's Juan Zarate, former Deputy National Security Advisor in the Bush administration, and now a senior advisor with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking about the alleged al-Qaeda glossy magazine that appeared online this past week. Juan Zarate, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Yeah, I think I will blow my vuvuzela. Plastic horn is the signature noise of the 2010 World Cup. Some people love them. Some people hate them. Some people are making a lot of money off of them. NPR's Carolyn Beeler reports.
Work stopped at a small company in Birmingham, Alabama, Friday morning. Employees gathered around the big screen TV in the common room to watch the Netherlands beat Brazil 2-1. The requisite vuvuzelas were floating around. They don't just blow the horns here. They sell them. Lots of them. Bernard Fry is the CEO of 365 Incorporated. In addition to the usual sports gear, he's sold 30,000 vuvuzelas in the last 8 months. But he admits he's no expert at playing the things.
It's not actually that easy. You need some lungs. Perhaps with a shandy it would be easier.
Fry first heard about the long plastic horns from a friend who'd seen them at a rugby game in South Africa. Fry thought there was no way they'd be popular here.
He called and just said, these things are awful. They're going to ruin the game. They've got to ban them. They've got to ban them. And pretty much a week later, Jeff Stevens, our head of marketing, came in and said, these things are going to be huge. We need to buy them.
Stevens knew the horns would be a hit with American sports fans because they like to be loud.
When he told me that he thought these were annoying, my reaction is Americans are going to love this because it's more along the lines of what you would see at an NBA game or a Major League Baseball game.
And so if Americans were going to buy these things, 365 Incorporated wanted to make sure they bought their vuvuzelas from them. The company bought Google search word ads using terms like South African horn and World Cup horn to drive traffic to their site. They started selling the horns in November, and sales took off.
We thought it would be a popular item. We thought it would sell well. But to the extent that it's performed, I probably never would have expected that to come, you know, in 100 years or 100 World Cups.
They've sold so fast, the company's supplier ran out of vuvuzelas. 365 and their parent company have enough horns stockpiled to last until they can find new producers. But at one point, they were worried their inventory wouldn't keep up with demand. So far, the vuvuzelas have brought in more than $250,000. Part of the reason sales have been so good, Fry says, is that this World Cup has attracted far more attention from Americans than the last one.
We've definitely seen a significant difference in the amount of interest in this World Cup. In the past, we were heavily focused on the German fans or the Italian fans or the Brazilian fans who live in the US. Now, there's no question that we've become an American company.
An American company selling horns made in China to people watching Brazil and the Netherlands play soccer in South Africa. Carolyn Beeler, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Peter Ward is a biologist at the University of Washington. He's not a historian, but in his new book, The Flooded Earth, he writes as a historian, but a historian describing the year 2120. And here's what happened to the city of Miami.
Miami had become an open city. It was also an island. Although to the north, it was still contiguous with the vast peninsula that had been Florida. The flooding had cut off all freeway and railroad ties, while the airport itself was now a vast lake. All this was because the level of the world's oceans had risen 10 feet. The reason for this vast geographic change, one that rendered every schoolchild's world atlas obsolete, was readily apparent. Greenland had lost its ice cover.
That's Peter Ward reading from his new book, The Flooded Earth. It paints a pretty bleak picture of how life on this planet will begin to change dramatically as early as 2050 as sea levels continue to rise. Peter Ward joins me from KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You paint a picture of Miami. The city becomes kind of an archipelago of little islands, mini islands, barely habitable. Is that really going to happen based on your projections?
It may not happen that early. That's the worst case scenario, but it will absolutely happen if we continue to be producing emissions at the rate that we are. I've now spent two field seasons in Antarctica. I've been able to look there at the recession of the glaciers and also of the ice sheets. Remember, everybody worries about ice cap, but ice floating on the sea, even if it all melts, has no direct effect on
sea
level.
It's like ice in a glass. If ice melts, it doesn't change the level.
But it's the ice on land. And the two critical places are Greenland and Antarctica. I mean, those are really what we must worry about. I almost want to print out T-shirts, keep the ice sheets, because we need to stabilize these.
You focus on mass extinction of humans, of animals. You're saying that sea levels will rise. They rise every day. They're rising as we speak. What's the best case scenario by the end of this century in terms of how high the sea will rise?
Best case scenario that I can see is going to be a little less than 3 feet.
So if we do nothing now, if we freeze...
We do nothing.
Mm-hmm, if we do nothing, we freeze our emissions now, the seas will still rise by about 3 feet by the end of this century.
3 feet, and from all the engineers I've talked to, and it's been an interesting ride for me, civilization can deal with up to a 5 foot sea level rise without major dislocation. Mm-hmm. But anything above 5 feet, and you're talking tremendous economic and biological dislocation.
Worst case scenario?
Worst case scenario would be 5 feet by 2100. But the problem with the 5 foot rise, sea level rise is something that doesn't take place at a constant level. It's accelerating. So once you have a 5 foot rise by 2100, you might have a 15 foot rise by 2200. So the 5 foot rise would be catastrophic economically, but would also really be pointing the gun to the head of all of the coastal cities. Sooner or later, within a century or two after that, you're going to be dealing with triage, trying to figure out what do we save and what don't we.
Where in the U.S. are we likely to see the effects? I mean, we think about, let's say, the eastern seaboard of the United States, and we can imagine what that looks like on a map, right? Will that look the same in 100 years?
In some senses, the place that would be most mitigated in terms of geography would be the entire Gulf region. I mean, that poor benighted place where we have all that nasty oil going ashore, that is the area where sea level will have the greatest impact.
So when you talk about the Gulf, you're talking about, for example, the Mississippi Delta?
Yes, the Mississippi Delta and every other delta on this planet is an endangered species. Deltas are completely tied into sea level. Even a 1 foot rise in sea level tremendously affects the sedimentology of delta formation. And here's why deltas are so important. An enormous proportion of the world's rice comes from the deltas in the tropical areas of the planet. When we have a rise even of a foot in sea level, we have many feet of lateral salt migration. The problem isn't the vertical rise of the sea. It is the fact that salt has this nasty habit of migrating sideways. And sideways into soil kills off agricultural crops. Salt and plants that produce crops just don't mix. Mangroves, if we could eat mangroves, we'd be in great shape. But we're looking at this confluence, and this is why I'm so disturbed. We're looking at a global population that's going from 6.6 billion to 9 billion. We're looking at a sea level rise from 1 to 3 feet, and we're looking at a reduction in arable land because of that sea level. So the equation is more people, less food.
You say that there are three possible outcomes of global warming. One, that scientists are wrong and that the ice caps won't actually melt. The second, that the ice caps will melt, but humans will adapt and they'll begin to cooperate. And the third is kind of a, I would call, a Mad Max scenario, where the ice caps melt and you have something akin to global anarchy. Which of these do you see as the most likely outcome?
I hope it's number two. I mean, this is just a hope. And we're looking back at history to try to understand how things happen. And yet we've never had an industrial civilization of our level in history encountering rising sea level. The fastest rise we know of in the past from ice age melting, though, is about 5 meters a century. So that's 15 feet in one century. We know from geological records it can go that fast. And this was in consequence to changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide far less than what we're doing now.
And that would have been the result of volcanoes, for example?
What we're doing to the atmosphere now is very similar to what I study in the deep past, which is the Permian extinction and the Triassic extinction, when there were enormous volcanic vents of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at rates that seem to be akin to what we're doing now. Now, we just came through a horrible global recession, and yet emissions globally did not reduce to where we hoped they were. Even with the recession, emissions keep going up. Carbon dioxide levels keep going up. If we return to full employment with all these extra people, what happens? Higher emissions, less ice sheet, higher sea level.
Peter Ward, all of the scenarios you lay out are quite shocking and they're fascinating. But I wonder, at what point does what all you say become tangible, become something that people can actually see and be affected by? Because, you know, one could argue that until that point, this is just theoretical, and it's difficult to get people to respond and to make changes.
Look, what if we're wrong about the sea level rise? What will we have done to mitigate it? We will have searched for alternative forms of energy, all good. We will have tried to do defenses on our coastlines, and with rising temperatures, we're going to get stronger hurricanes, all good. So even if the sea level doesn't rise, the attempts to defense it are actually very powerful and positive things. The alternative, doing nothing, well, maybe we'll get away with it. Maybe we'll dodge the bullet. But what if we don't?
That's Peter Ward. He's a professor of biology and earth and space sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. and author of the new book, The Flooded Earth. Peter Ward, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. First and last, Barry Peterson's new book is a love story, but the story of a love that had to change to endure. His wife, Jan, was the kind of spirited, effervescent person who made strangers smile. They had full, interesting lives, blessed with children, friends, and travel. But after 20 years of marriage, when Jan was just in her mid-50s, she was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's disease. The life they had built began to crack. Their love began to change from the affection and intimacy of two adults to patient and caregiver. And finally, Barry Peterson had to figure out how to fulfill his pledge of in sickness and in health to the woman he loved without dashing his life for himself and his family. Mr. Peterson is a veteran and acclaimed correspondent for CBS News who's reported on vexing human stories from around the world. Now he's written his own, Jan's story, love lost to the long goodbye of Alzheimer's. Barry Peterson joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And did you make a point of calling it Jan's story?
I did. People have asked why I wrote the book, and I say to them, one of the reasons is I would not let this woman, this magnificent, vivacious, wonderful woman, just get lost in the mist of Alzheimer's. I couldn't let her life end that way. And if there is a way to honor her, then I dearly hope this is it.
In this book, looking back on it before she was diagnosed, you think you might have recognized signs even a decade before.
The researchers say that Alzheimer's can start more than 20 years before it can be diagnosed. And I think with Jan it started when she was 40 years old. This is 1990. She was not formally diagnosed until 2005. That's 15 years later. But we could see the signs. I didn't want to see the signs, but other people saw them. The subtle changes. Her ambition started to wane. She didn't really want to go out of the house very much. And, of course, memory lapses. I mean, at times, and now permanently, but at times she'd forget who I was. We'd be together, and she'd say, I saw a picture of you in the other room. Do you live in this apartment? And then if you just gave her a little time and a little bit of time, it would kind of come back. But the cruelty of that, I cannot describe, because all you hold on to, all you clutch, is the coming back part. It's not as bad as I thought. She's getting better. Something good is happening. And then she goes away, except each time a little farther away.
You were her caregiver for a while, tried to be.
Yes. I took care of her alone as long as I could. We were living in both Tokyo and Beijing. We would go back and forth. The travel was a problem. I'm a working journalist. I traveled a lot. Brought in a live-in caregiver, a retired nurse from Washington State, who was marvelous. I thought with the live-in caregiver, I'd solve the problem for like another 2 or 3 years. We lasted 8 months. And this is perhaps the worst part and the most difficult part of this for me. The woman who was the caregiver, the nurse who was monitoring both of us, said, Jan is always going to have someone to look out for her. The caregiver has no one to look out for the caregiver. And then she looked me in the eyes and said, you are going down. My health was beginning to suffer. I almost literally walked off a cliff. I don't mean like I thought about walking off a cliff. I mean, I was in a house that was next to a cliff, and I thought this is a way to end the pain, was to walk off a cliff. You know, I was smart enough to know that in many cases, caregivers die before the person with the disease. But I thought that was, you know, people in their 80s and 90s, not Barry the journalist. But Barry the journalist had to realize that this disease was taking me down with it and that I had to put Jan into an assisted living facility and that that would be the end of Barry and Jan.
Some of her friends were angry at you. You're good enough to share some of those phone calls and letters in the book.
They felt that I had abandoned her. One friend said, if I ever really loved Jan, I would have quit my job, moved to Seattle where we'd placed her in this facility. I'd go see her every day, and I would be there for as many minutes as Jan had left when she could still have some sense of who I was. I've decided that I'm going to accept that, and I got to tell you, it hurt a lot. I thought I was doing something really good to care for her, so that hurt. But I decided these people said that because, like me, they love Jan. And they could look at me and I could personify their anger. I could personify what this disease had done to her. And so I take this now as a measure of their affection for Jan. Let them be angry with me. Let them say I did everything wrong. To me, it just means they cared for her so much, and that I will hold on to.
And how's Jan doing?
You know, it's hard to know. It goes from visit to visit. I must tell you that when I go to see her, sometimes she recognizes that I'm a person of importance. She doesn't know who I am. She doesn't know I'm Barry. There's a different Barry who lives in her mind, and that's from her memories from a long time ago. But she recognizes I'm somewhat important. And I got to tell you, there was a moment a couple of visits ago. I came to see her. She's like, oh, you know, she sees me, and we talked for a minute. And she looked over, and she said, will you marry me? And it was like the sweetest thing that she could have said. You know, we've been married for many, many years. I don't know how in the world you react to that. I know that when I was done with the visit and went outside and had to think about this, you know, I wept because it was such a sweet thing for her to find somewhere in what is left of her memory the sense that I was the person, whoever that person was, however she sees me with what's left of her mind. I was a person that she said, will you marry me? In every sense of the word, it was almost impossible to contemplate, and yet how lovely that she felt that.
Barry, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Barry Peterson, his new book, Jan's Story. He spoke with us from New York. Back in Washington, D.C., President Obama has to turn his attention to the economy. There are growing fears that recovery may be slowing down. The housing market's at a standstill. Consumer spending's down. People are still losing their jobs. We're joined now by NPR News analyst Juan Williams. Juan, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
And let's start with jobs, because this really has become the centerpiece of concern now all throughout the government. Yesterday's report by the Labor Department was mixed. 125,000 people lost jobs last month. A lot of that was the temporary jobs that were created by the census. Stimulus money is all spent, right? What can the government do to create jobs?
Well, this morning, President Obama in his radio internet address said the economy is moving in the right direction, but it's just not fast enough. And beyond blaming Republicans for not having a jobs bill, President Obama then cited what he called good news, things like, you know, creating 600,000 jobs in the private sector this year. And that's a big shift from last year, when in the first 6 months, the U.S. lost 3.7 million jobs. So when you stop and think about it, where is the growth right now? Education, health services, hospitals, leisure. The losses are in construction, state and local government, the census jobs that you were talking about. So that's where the issue is right now, to try to find areas of the economy that can grow.
And is there some political friction in the fact that, according to polls, people are more and more concerned about the size of the deficit, about how much money government has been spending?
Jobs are the number one issue, but then ironically, deficit spending is the number two issue. And there's some tension there because there's pressure on the government, as you hear from President Obama, to put more money into job stimulus spending. And then you hear the response, especially from the Republicans, that the deficit is just ungainly and it's not the appropriate time to be spending money when we have such concerns that the deficit may sink us.
Yeah. And I hear there's an election coming up in November, too, right? Which doesn't always help the reconciliation process, does it?
No. And you know, the thing is, President Obama, for example, when he announced today $2 billion for new solar energy projects. The idea, he says, is to create jobs. He wants to create new industries, economies that will take root in the U.S., like, you know, green jobs and the like. So that's what he's trying to do, find those emerging industries that maybe are coming from Europe or Asia and say, no, let's have them here in the United States as job creation machines.
And, of course, this week the Senate adjourned without passing an extension of unemployment benefits for people who've been out of work for 6 months. This becomes a campaign issue.
Big campaign issue, and it's a problematic one for Republicans if they are perceived as being insensitive or uncaring for people, many of whom are now suffering what we call long-term unemployment, more than 27 weeks. Yeah. And the state governments, everybody else is screaming because they're feeling increased economic pressure as well. So spending for things like Medicaid and on the poor could be impacted directly as well as unemployment. So it's a really difficult one to figure out.
So, but whatever you do, don't add to the deficit. That's what the instruction of the poll seems to be.
That's the whole thing.
Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele, apparently, I guess it was at a voter, at an appearance in Connecticut that he thought was off the record, called the war in Afghanistan the war of Obama's choosing. There have been calls from some big-name Republicans for him to resign.
Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard, said it's 4th of July weekend, do the patriotic thing and step down. Republicans, as you know, Scott, have been tremendous supporters of the war in Afghanistan. And for the chairman of the Republican Party then to turn around and say this is Obama's war really struck Kristol wrong. Michael Steele called me yesterday. I think it's evidence that he feels he has to play defense, especially with the media. It's a tough moment for him. My guess is he'll survive.
NPR's Juan Williams, thanks so much.
You're welcome.